Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene is the word, the Science Forum, as we've gathered today our duo of science experts to respond to your questions and comments. You can give us a call right now, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. There are other ways. You want some other ways? I'll tell you some other ways. You can post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. Go to wamc.org/voxpop and you can comment there. Or you can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wamcradio. Or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. But the phone is always a good thing. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Let's meet our scientists.
I'm George Shaw. I'm a retired geology professor.
Okay.
I'm Ed Stander, astronomy and a non-retired geology professor.
All right, gentlemen, nice to have you here. And while we wait for the phone calls to come in at 1-800-348-2551, you guys told me before we started the program that you have some events coming up. And frankly, they both mystify me. We'll start with Ed. You're doing a presentation on what now?
Well, there is a presentation, is a symposium of two-year biology people.
Mm-hmm.
And since we have a new observatory on campus at Cobleskill, we decided that we had to do something with it. And so I was given the job of figuring out something to do.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's going to be raining on Friday, so we're not going to look through the observatory. So suddenly I had to figure out something else. So I made the mistake of saying I would do it on astroforensics because the topic of the conference is forensics.
So what is that?
Well, that was it. I didn't know that astroforensics actually existed until I discovered it. I invented it. And it turns out...
You invented it.
I invented it. Uh-huh. It turns out that the first case of astroforensics was in 1857 when this guy, lawyer figured out that a murder could not have been seen by a witness because the moon was too low in the sky and it was a first quarter.
You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding you.
This sounds like a bad novel. This is true?
It's a true story, and the lawyer was Abraham Lincoln, so it made it even better.
Wow, that's terrific. Yeah. So, all right, that's the first 10 minutes of your presentation. What happens after that?
Oh, I talk about how you can figure out when, for example, the picture Moonrise by Van Gogh was made. 1898 on July 24th at 4:35 p.m. because that's when the moon was in the right spot to do that.
Wow.
You can figure out who done it in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You can do a lot of stuff. So it's lots of fun, and I figure at least I learned something.
You're assuming Van Gogh was good. I mean, if he was a little off, it could have been any day.
It could have been 4:35. It could have been almost 4:40 even.
All right,
so it really all depends.
George Shaw, you have an interesting event coming up as well.
Yes, on Saturday, I'll be doing a remote presentation to the Astronomy Day at the University of Minnesota Duluth on terraforming Mars.
Terraforming Mars. And, I mean, we've heard this in science fiction. Is this a realistic thing that we could look forward to at some point in the future?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the point is that the characteristics of Mars are such that it is a physical possibility. It would require a lot of effort and cost, but it probably can be done.
So when you say terraforming for those listening at home and those hopefully about to call at 1-800-348-2551, when you say terraforming Mars, what does that exactly mean?
Well, it could mean different things. As a minimum, it would mean providing Mars with a climate that's much closer to Earth. That doesn't necessarily mean people could walk around and breathe. The simplest bit of terraforming would result in Mars with an atmosphere that you couldn't breathe, but it would be a dense enough atmosphere and would have a significantly high greenhouse effect so that liquid water could exist on the surface.
So the average temperature now in the day on Mars is?
Well, Mars' average temperature is about minus 55 degrees centigrade.
In the day?
On the dark side.
On the dark side. On the dark side?
No. That's the average temperature. The maximum temperature is about 27 degrees, and the minimum is about minus 145.
Okay, so through terraforming, and what would you do? Put lichens down or something and hope that you get the greenhouse effect that way? But you would then make the atmosphere dense and try to equalize the temperature swings?
Yeah, actually, you come up with the real essence of the idea is the way you do it is with biology. And we know Mars has water. We know Mars has carbon dioxide, and it's got other carbon compounds on it, I'm quite sure. And if you could convert those into a combination of methane and ammonia, those gases have much stronger greenhouse effects, and you could use that to raise the average temperature to much closer to what the Earth has now.
Could you raise the average low temperature as well?
Oh, yes. It would be raising the low temperature as well.
Interesting. I don't know to what end you'd want to do that if people couldn't eventually walk around.
Well, that would be the first stage. Now, once you've got an environment where it's much easier to get around in, that is an air pressure so that you do not need a pressure suit, you'd have to carry your oxygen, but it's a lot easier to carry oxygen than it is to work in a pressure suit.
Interesting. Now, our guests here on the Science Forum, Ed Stander, who is at SUNY Cobleskill.
Yeah. Right.
And George Shaw, who is retired geologist. And, you know, we're talking about terraforming here of Mars. And Bob Berman is a regular on the show. He does the astronomy show. And this question comes up often about sending people to Mars. And he says, well, the radiation is such that, you know, even if you're wearing a protective suit, your brain eventually gets fried if you're there long enough because of the radiation, it not having a magnetic field to stop the radiation. So how far can terraforming then go?
Well, it would certainly reduce some of the radiation impacts if Mars had a denser atmosphere. Even if the surface radiation is potentially threatening, there are protective measures that you could take. An atmosphere will do a pretty good job of stopping the high energy particles. You'd still probably have some problem with ultraviolet, but remember, you're further from the sun,
yeah,
so the intensity is lower. And if you could ultimately terraform it so that there's free oxygen in the atmosphere, that would reduce the impact of the ultraviolet. So it depends on where you go with it, how far you can get.
I assume they would only go anywhere with it if there was a buck to be made. So they'd have to find some precious minerals there worth mining, I would assume.
That's a possibility.
And the other part of it, of course, is if there's a solar flare or something going off, you just go to the other side of Mars and Mars protects you.
Well, fair enough. All right, now we have a phone call or two. Let's go to Dell in Rotterdam. Dell, you're on the Science Forum. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Ray?
I'm well. And yourself?
I'm doing very well. I have a question for your geologist, and it regards the pine bush.
Okay.
I know how the pine bush has been defined by protectionists and developers and the local governments, but how far does the pine bush actually extend? And I have a personal interest in this very briefly, in that I live in Rotterdam, and it seems to me that the sandy soil and everything else that exists over here is pine bush like.
It's true. Over on King Street and all that range over there in the sort of the woods there. Yep.
This is strange.
Yes.
We've got two geologists here, so we have to ask each other who's going to answer.
All right, gentlemen, why don't you fight it out?
The pine bush. Did you know the pine bush was actually talked about in Moby Dick?
I did not.
Yeah, he actually describes the ocean as being as vast as the pine bush in Albany.
I did not know.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
the pine bush is an area that used to be part of Glacial Lake Albany. It's at the bottom of what used to be Glacial Lake Albany. And the sands that were there effectively are sands and outwash that was left by the glacier. Lake Albany, I believe, extended as far as almost up to where Lake, it was connected to Lake Champlain at one time and extended all the way down the Hudson River Valley.
So it covered all of what Lake George is?
More or less.
Interesting.
More or less. And effectively what happened was when the glacier left, it had taken all the trees out with it. And so there's just a lot of sand around. And the sand, in a lot of part of it, became like a desert. It became a sand dunes. If you go up the north way near Albany, for example, you can actually still see the sand dunes. And they're all through the pine bush.
Interesting.
So it extended over a very large area. And it's pretty well, if you look up Glacial Lake Albany on the internet, for example, you can get a pretty good idea of what the extremes of it are.
So the, very good. I'll definitely look that up.
Perfect. All right. And all right. Does that answer your question to some extent, Del?
Yes, it sure, certainly does. Thanks very much, fellas.
Thank you very much. Now, Lake Albany was after the last ice age. When
that's right.
when was it
right.
here? 10,000, 20,000 years ago? Tell me.
Roughly 10,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it, there were stages of the decline of Lake Albany as it drained.
And how far down did south of Albany did it go?
I think to Newburgh. There was a glacial dam somewhere down near Newburgh, and of course that's been removed by erosion, and that drained the lake.
Very interesting. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break and be back with more phone calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Molly Cantor Pottery, taking part in the Asparagus Valley Pottery Trail, a self-guided driving tour of 9 pottery studios in western Massachusetts, April 27th and 28th, at potterytrail.com. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, arriving daily, shrubs, fruit trees, perennials, pansies, and violas ready for planting, wardsnursery.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years, collegestreetmotors.com. The Unitarian Universalist Congregations of the Capital Region and beyond, teaching children how to build bridges in our increasingly multicultural world, capitalregionuu.org. And the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies, Millbrook, New York, fishery expert Ray Hilborn to speak about his new book, Overfishing, What Everyone Needs to Know, April 19th at 7 p.m., careyinstitute.org.
Nice to have some people more or less in the same age ballpark here. The scientists and I all bopping here to the theme from Johnny Quest on the Science Forum. Ed Stander is here. George Shaw is here. Your questions about anything science-related, they'll take a shot. 1-800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go. Michael in Harriman, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an astronomy question.
All right.
I'm wondering, with all the stars that are out there, is there an estimate on... my understanding is that a planet of any kind orbiting a star is not, it's a very uncommon phenomenon. How many planets do they estimate are out there?
Well, what they've done recently is they put up a satellite called Kepler. And Kepler focused on a very, very, very small part of the sky continuously, because there's only really two ways we have to find planets right now. One way is if the planet's very big, and as a result, it makes the sun wobble around it. And we can actually see the wobble of the sun by looking at its spectrum. The other way is if the planet eclipses the sun. So all of a sudden, the light of the sun goes down a little bit. That's really the only two ways we have to find planets. And if we want to find Earth-like planets, we can only use the second one. Because the first one, in order to make a sun wobble, and in order to make it wobble like every 5 or 10 days, so it's actually observable, it's got to be a huge planet, and it's got to be right near the sun, which is why almost all the planets we've discovered up till now are huge and near the sun. But the Kepler, looking in this one small area of sky, has seen over a possibility of 3,000 planets so far.
Wow. Now, how many stars is in that small area that Kepler's looking at?
I'm not really sure. There's several thousand, certainly. But what it's coming out with is that almost every sun out there has got a planet on it, at least one planet going around it. And you have to remember that in order for a planet to eclipse around the sun, it's got to be exactly in the right orientation with respect to us. So if we found 3,000 planets, there's probably on the order of 300,000 or more in the area. So there's a huge number of planets out there.
More than I thought. Thanks.
Thanks, certainly. Michael. So that brings us back to terraforming Mars and planets. and by the way, the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551. So, George, they always talk about this sort of Goldilocks zone that the Earth is in. They're just right, you know, warm enough, but not too hot and not too cold. Mars is also in. Is this zone much bigger than we're led to believe here by popular perception?
It depends on the nature of the planetary chemistry, and in particular the atmospheric chemistry. If you put an Earth-like atmosphere with nitrogen, oxygen, etc. around Mars, it would not work.
Mm-hmm.
The planet would not have a strong enough greenhouse effect, and it would basically freeze. Now, the interesting thing is that we know that conditions on Mars were much closer to Earth-like about 3.5 billion years ago, because there's very strong evidence that there was liquid water on the surface.
Now, what happened? Was the sun stronger then? Or?
No, as a matter of fact, the sun was weaker then. It was about 20 to 30% less luminous than it is now. And this is a great puzzle. If Mars was so livable or so warm back then and wet, how did it turn out to be cold and dry, even though the sun was getting more intense over the last 4 billion years?
Yeah.
And the answer is that there must have been greenhouse gases around Mars at that time, which are no longer there. And people have tried to do this explaining it with carbon dioxide, because we know there is carbon dioxide on Mars, and in fact, most of Mars' atmosphere is carbon dioxide. The problem is that carbon dioxide doesn't work. You need so much of it, way more than we could conceivably justify. So it must have been some other greenhouse gases that were doing the trick. Either that, or all of our models about the sun, about stars, are wrong, which I doubt is the case.
That would be bad, because maybe our sun would go out next week. We wouldn't know.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah, let's go back to the phones. Seth in Albany. Seth, you're on.
Yeah, I had a question regarding the terraforming and making the atmosphere denser so that there could be liquid water.
Yes.
And so my question was, if there could be liquid water, and is there enough minerals in the soil on Mars to plant vegetation and whatnot that could eat, you know, that could take in the carbon dioxide and create oxygen?
The simple answer is yes. We know there's a fair amount of carbon dioxide. And if we can create the right conditions, photosynthesis could take place and the carbon dioxide could be converted to oxygen. We don't know how much carbon dioxide is on Mars, because there's only a little bit of Mars that we can see, and we're not really sure much about what's beneath the surface.
Okay.
Yeah, we've also found calcium and a number of other minerals on the surface, all of which are needed to grow plants.
And so the question would be, if there was enough carbon dioxide, could we make enough oxygen that we could breathe on Mars?
Yes, that would be the ultimate goal of terraforming, is producing something that would be stage two of a terraforming. It's much harder to do that than it is to do stage one.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. Now, the polar caps on Mars, they're ice, but are they water? Is methane? What is it?
Ice.
Oh, it's carbon dioxide.
Well, actually, most of it is probably water ice. There is a relatively thin layer of frozen carbon dioxide on the top of what was mostly water ice, at least in terms of the northern polar cap. And that carbon dioxide is relatively volatile. So during the northern summer, the northern polar cap will start subliming and the CO2 gets transferred to the south pole. And vice versa when the seasons change. And Mars does have seasons similar to those of Earth.
And I've heard talk of methane there. Is that indicative in any way of the possibility of life, microbial or otherwise?
It's been hyped as such. I very much doubt that the methane is an indicator of life. That's my personal view.
So there are no cows having gas on Mars?
No, and there are plenty of other ways. There are fairly straightforward, non-organic ways of generating methane. Hot spring environments would be a very good place to generate methane. And we know there are hot springs on Mars. We actually have pictures of hot springs on the Martian surface. I mean, they're not maybe not hot now, but we can see the deposits that were formed around these springs.
All right. And by the way, if they do terraform, we are taking money for land.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
That's Ed.
This is terrific. Ed is going to start something. Maybe you start a website like the Star Registry, right?
I'm looking at $2,000 an acre right now.
Right, fair.
Towards the equator.
Remember, this is public radio, so we'll have to
I'll give. I'll give 5% of anything we take in to public radio.
Interesting. Well, underwriting, we'll vet that, and we'll get back to you. Ellen, where are you calling from, Ellen?
Hi.
Oh, Alan, I'm sorry. Alan, where are you calling from?
Hinsdale, Mass.
Oh, Hinsdale. Hi, you're on.
Thanks. Yeah, my question, is it Ed?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. My question is about carbon dioxide, but here back on Earth, it seems like most of our heat on Earth comes from the sun, and they talk about the carbon dioxide causing the global warming, reflecting heat back down onto the Earth. But my question is, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, why isn't it reflecting the heat from the sun or a good chunk of it back into outer space?
Okay. Well, no one's jumping at this. So.
Well, he's asking, but
well, it doesn't really matter. I'll take either one.
Okay, well, somebody.
Effectively, when the light from the sun hits the Earth, it changes its frequency to infrared, which is effectively like a heat lamp. And the infrared light is what's absorbed by the by carbon dioxide. So the light can get in without a problem, but the infrared has a hard time getting out. Correct?
Correct.
Good.
It sounds like a pair of polarized glasses or something where it's a little confusing to me. I mean, I believe in global warming and all that, but with the carbon dioxide, if it can block it, is it just because the sun's rays are so much stronger coming in that what little bit gets reflected doesn't matter, but when the heat tries to reflect off the Earth, that does matter more?
Most of the energy coming in sunlight is at wavelengths that are shorter than the infrared. So the visible light has an easy time of getting through the atmosphere. The atmosphere is transparent to infrared, or transparent to visible. Infrared radiation is a longer wavelength, and if you tried to look at a heat lamp through a good infrared absorber, and carbon dioxide's a sort of a good infrared absorber, then what you would see is that the infrared lamp would be dimmed dramatically by the absorber between you and the lamp. And that's, the lamp is the Earth's surface, the absorber is the CO2 in the atmosphere. So if you go off the planet and look back, what you see is less infrared coming through than you would if you removed the CO2 completely.
Interesting.
So in other words, the heat from the sun's kind of below that infrared scale, but the heat coming off the Earth is the infrared, so it can't sneak back out.
Right.
That's pretty close to that.
Light's a continuum. Visible light and infrared light or microwaves are all the same thing, just a different wavelength. And certain wavelengths are able to get through and certain wavelengths have absorbed. That's effectively what's happening.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me now. I didn't realize there's different frequencies or whatever of this type of infrared. So, well, that answers my question. Thanks very much. Have a good day.
Alan, thank you. And the number to call here on the Science Forum is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Ed Stander and George Shaw are with us, and we're just talking about planets today, and that's just the way things roll sometimes. So let's talk about Venus. Now, Venus, they tell me, and I know next to nothing, I'm in radio, it is a sort of a runaway greenhouse effect, and it's hot and sulfurous and hellish, but it reflects a lot of light. So how does this correspond to what we just talked about as far as the Earth and the reflected light from the Earth?
Well, Venus has clouds, which are basically aerosol droplets, and those have very different optical properties. So some of the visible light, in the same way that if you go off Earth, you can see the cloud tops because the aerosols in the clouds are reflecting light back into space, and Venus does the same thing.
Okay. Now, Venus, of course, was theoretically is in a good spot to harbor a nice, happy environment too, right?
It's about twice the temperature of Earth, which makes it just hot enough that water starts evaporating. And if you get a lot of water in the atmosphere, well, water acts as a greenhouse gas as well, and that starts it off.
So it's just a little too close.
Right.
Right.
All right, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. It's Jeff in Gardner. Jeff, your turn.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hello.
I have what I hope is going to be a basic question about astronomy. On one page, they say that the universe is expanding and all the galaxies are moving apart. And then on the next page, it tells you that our closest galaxy, Andromeda, is like basically heading directly towards us, and is, we're going to like collide with it.
Right.
Can you please help me understand those two at the same time?
Fair enough.
Well, galaxies are not randomly distributed through space. There are groups of galaxies. Andromeda and about 19 others are part of what's called a local group of galaxies, and they're all attracted by each other's gravity. And then off in the distance is another group called the Vega Supercluster, and further out there's one called the Coma Cluster. And each of those groups of galaxies are attracted to each other due to gravity. But the groups themselves move independently away from each other. Although,
okay.
Actually, in the case of those three, they're actually moving towards each other to some extent, but that's just because they happen to be in that area.
Didn't have to tell me that.
Sorry.
I think we're going to be okay either way.
Yeah, but generally speaking, as the universe expands, these groups of galaxies move away from each other. But within the galaxy itself, within a group of galaxies, they could be attracted by each other's gravity.
And am I correct in thinking that our solar system was formed by the collision of some galaxies?
Well,
because the age of our solar system is so much younger than the age of what the Big Bang would be.
Well, as a star grows and dims and finally dies, it shoots off all the garbage that it had into space, and that becomes nucleus for the next solar system. So in our case, we're probably the nth variety of solar systems that have formed in the same area. So
okay.
You start off with a star. The star blows up. It sends out all its material into space. That material then collects together, forms the next solar system.
That's a new generation.
That's right.
Okay, geez, thank you so much.
Jeff, thank you. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. You know, we can talk about Earth as well, if you like. 800-348-2551. George Shaw is here at Stander. And Dennis in Hinsdale, you're on. Dennis.
Hey, how you doing? I got a question. What about this? If we started having white shingles on our roofs and painted the roads white as a way to reflect the heat back into space to lower the temperature of the Earth a little bit, you know, because to replace the ice that's melting that reflects the Earth heat back. You know
okay,
I mean?
Well, gentlemen, what do you think?
Well, if you look at the surface areas involved and what might the cost of painting a whole bunch of stuff white. It's probably a lot more cost-effective to keep the ice in place. To say nothing of maintenance.
Okay, but in theory, then, if pie in the sky, is what Dennis is saying true?
Like, in other words, we have to replace roofs every, 20 years or so, and if we're replacing them with white shingles, for example, that's not any more expensive than any other color shingles.
It'll keep the house cooler, too.
Yeah.
How many roofs would you need to significantly affect that?
Well, I'd do it to the roads first.
Yeah?
There's a lot of roads out there and a lot of driveways.
The problem with that is that you got stuff running around on the roads, and maintaining this would be incredibly expensive.
Well, then you have to have white tires as well.
It would be tough to see, though, right? Need some really strong sunglasses, right?
Well, then I'm for selling sunglasses.
Okay, so you can sell them on Mars.
You don't need them on Mars. It's not enough light on Mars.
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. Very interesting angle. Thank you. We appreciate it. Let's go to Mike in Brant Lake. Mike, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an ongoing debate with an engineer friend of mine, and he claims that all the data is on his side, and intuitively I know I'm right. Anyway. The question is this, with all the RF energy of full spectrum that we as humans pump into the atmosphere, I can't help but think that the long-term effects would be dire for us. He claims that the amount of energy, the radio wave energy that we're pumping in the atmosphere is absolutely insignificant compared to what we get from the sun in any given period of time.
How dare you doubt an engineer? All right, scientists?
Well, okay. You should Google Robert Parks at the American Physical Society, who has looked at this and commented on this for years and years. And the evidence, including epidemiological evidence, is on the side of your engineer friend. And there are very good reasons to think that radio frequency energy is of minimal significance, because the quantum energy effect of radio frequency is below what's needed to break chemical bonds. And Robert Parks, if you look him up, you can read reams and reams of material on this particular topic.
How about electrical signals? In other words, synapses firing electrical signals, could they not be affected by certain frequencies of RF?
I doubt it.
Okay.
Well, we know that certain kind of process going on.
All right, Mike. Any follow up?
Robert Parks. That's the look up there.
Robert yeah. Parks, American Physical Society.
And as far as the brain is concerned, generally speaking, neurons and such have a sheath around them to protect them from each other.
Mm.
And if it were possible, that'd be a major problem.
Interesting. Of course, we do know that certain frequencies are more deadly to flesh than others, but
very high frequencies, X-rays, gamma rays, even ultraviolet, which is lower frequency,
high energy.
All those have enough quantum energy to break chemical bonds, and of course that's how they do the damage.
Let's take a break, Mr. Zach the engineer, and we'll be back with more calls. 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum.
Support for WAMC comes from Washington County Tourism, announcing Farm and Fiber Tour, featuring spinning, knitting, and weaving demonstrations, showcasing alpacas, goats, sheep, and more, April 27th and 28th, WashingtonNYCounty.com. Little Wolf Architecture, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing collaborative discovery and design for dwellings in the regional landscape, featuring passive house and natural home strategies, LittleWolfARCH.com. Boyden and Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years, boydenandperron.com. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of Lake George, hiking guides, events, and more, lglc.org.
And we're back on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. Now, Patrick Dundas, our producer, was just in here, and he says, according to Twitter, the Boston police on Twitter, no arrests have been made in the Boston Marathon bombings. Some of the broadcast and cable news networks seem to be backtracking from initial reports about an hour ago that there was an arrest imminent or had already happened. And we're watching this. We're watching it from every angle, and according to what Patrick told me, Boston police have tweeted no arrest. So we will keep you posted. Everything's in a state of flux, and that's the way we like it on the Science Forum. Let's go to, is it Tare in Pittsfield?
Yes.
You are on the show. Thanks for being here. We can't really hear you.
Are there any more elements yet to be discovered?
Aha. Are there any more elements yet to be discovered?
Well, it depends on what you mean by discovered. Most of the heavy elements have been manufactured. They're made in the laboratory. And it's certainly conceivable that some heavier elements might still be manufactured in a laboratory setting. But
even if they do, they only last for microseconds before they break down.
All right, Tara, thank you. But, I mean, if they are able to be manufactured, is there a spot in the middle of a supernova or something where they might exist in nature?
Well, for the microsecond that they exist.
Yeah, when you have a supernova, that's when all the heavier elements are created. Mm-hmm. And things that are far heavier than a supernova is incredibly energetic, and certainly the possibility exists that some of these might have been produced, but they have half-lives that are incredibly short.
So they really would do us no good.
No.
There could be many more, but we... Right. Nothing we can do about it.
Well, they do good for the person who discovers them. They get their name on it.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Let's go to Bob in Saratoga. Bob, you're on.
Yes, I have a question. It's bothered me for some time. All the measurements we do assume, we're taking all the measurements as the light that reaches us, but since light travels at light speed, these places may be millions or larger light years away. Has anyone ever thought to say, well, what does it look like if we could adjust for that speed of light?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, I mean, if you're looking at a place that's 5 billion years ago, or 5 million years ago was a galaxy or something was over here, mm-hmm. and then another one's 8 million years ago away, light-wise.
Okay.
Where would they look relative to each other at the current instant in time?
Well, here's the trick. When you look at a star, for example, or a galaxy, you get a spectrum signal from it, which can tell mm-hmm. you what's in that galaxy.
Correct.
And each of the lines in the spectrum give you some idea of what the elements are in the galaxy. If the galaxy would look much different, then the lines would also be different. And what we do see is that there's a shifting of the shifting of it. That's called redshift. As the galaxies are moving away from us. In fact, that's how we know the galaxies are moving away from us.
But you're looking at a certain star that occurs supposedly in all the galaxies, and that's your measuring point.
Right. If you measure that, you'll see that the star will seem a little bit redder than it should actually because of that. But because of that, we could actually go back and see what that star would actually be like because we know what the elements that are in it and how much it's redshifted. And generally speaking, it doesn't seem to have much of an effect.
Well, I was just saying, you know, if something's light's been traveling for 5 million years, mm-hmm. another one has been traveling for 50 million years, that obviously one is further away or closer than at the same instant in time, that's all.
Okay. Well, light doesn't get old.
No, I mean, just talking about the true distance of the actual bodies emitting the light, you know, the stars.
Sure. Well, what it goes through, if it goes through things in between, that can have an effect. But that's really the only effect that there would be. Otherwise, the star that you see may have a little bit of redshift, but that would be about it.
Okay.
They're maybe quoting the distance of a star or galaxy from us. They're already adjusting for the fact that they really don't know the distance. They can't really judge the age of the light.
Well, they do know the distance to a lot of stars. You can tell the distance either by parallax or by, there's about 5 different ways of telling it. So we do know approximately the distance. And when we plot them up, we also know the redshift, so we can determine how much off it is.
All right. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to George in Great Barrington. Hiya, George. You're on.
Hey, how you doing? I got my tinfoil hat on. I'm ready for you guys.
Well, so do I. So you're good to go.
Okay. It's a well-known fact that the universe is constantly expanding. I've always been of the belief that at some point in our near history, that Mars, we've moved into a sweet spot around the sun. Mars could have been in that sweet spot at one point, could have sustained life, been a very viable place to live at some point.
Okay.
But it's expanded out. I mean, the moon is moving away from our planet at a pace of about 1 foot per year.
Well, an inch and a half a year.
Oh, it is? Okay. I thought it was more than that.
All right, so tides are still in our future for a little while. What about this other part?
Expansion of the universe is on a scale which is much, much larger than the solar system or the galaxy. In other words, we're not expanding. My waistline is expanding. But basically speaking, gravity, local gravity is more important than the expansion of the universe. So mm-hmm. the idea that the solar system has expanded and that Mars used to be where the Earth is and it's moving outward doesn't work. Effectively, Mars is, if anything, it's moved inward by the gravity of the sun.
Okay.
If that makes sense to you?
Makes sense, yep.
All right, George. Hey, thanks a lot. Let's go to Noel in Poughkeepsie. Or is it Noel? I can't tell.
Yes, that's Noel.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Thanks for taking my call.
All right.
Just a quick question. I was wondering, has there ever been a comparative analysis of the impact on global warming from volcanic eruptions around the world versus, say, the percentage of mankind's contribution?
Yes, there's several detailed studies of this, and some of the most recent analyses do a very close analysis of the effects of volcanic eruptions in terms of producing effects that we can see in the temperature records. There's a group at, I think it's Cal Berkeley, who just came out with a recent report. It's probably the most detailed analysis of temperature changes and the various factors that might produce these temperature changes, including volcanic eruptions. So we have actually have a very good handle on this.
And what's the upshot? I mean, I would think that the volcano, initially a big one, would lower the temperature because of cloud cover.
Exactly.
Right.
Then would it raise it in the long run because of gases emitted?
It doesn't necessarily raise it in the long run. A lot depends on what kind of gases come out. For Pinatubo, it ejected an awful lot of sulfur oxides, and that actually accentuated cooling because they served as condensation nuclei and increased average cloud cover for about a year or two and produced an overall cooling.
And you can actually see this whenever there's a lunar eclipse, for example.
Right.
Because what's happening there is the light from the sun is going through the atmosphere and then hitting the moon. Back in the 1970s, when there was a lunar eclipse, the moon was dark. It was almost black during the eclipse because the light was being absorbed by the atmosphere because of all the particles from volcanic eruptions. And nowadays, the last lunar eclipse we had, it turns orange or red.
Yeah.
And that's because the light is now going through the atmosphere. So you can see how much light can get through the atmosphere by looking at the eclipses. That's
very interesting question. Noel, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Paul in Niverville. Paul, you're on.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, this is another question on global warming. Now, we hear a lot of bad effects that could come from it. Isn't there any positive effects, like maybe longer growing seasons or growing seasons in different areas that may be productive?
Well, let's see. The head of NASA came out a number of years ago and said that global warming may actually be a good thing, and he was almost fired.
Oh.
It's the kind of thing that you're not supposed to say.
Politics.
Yeah, politics. Well, yeah, certainly there are good things and there are bad things associated with it. Back in the time of the dinosaurs, the temperature was much, much higher than it is now, and they seem to have enjoyed it.
Oh. Right. Well, that's a point. So I guess it depends on...
It depends on what you
good
like.
Good for whom, yeah. All right. Hey, Paul, thanks a lot. Let's go to Bill in Pittsfield. Bill.
Yeah. Hi. I was wondering, to cure global warming, could we put the sense that atmosphere is, I forget how many miles that occurs, but since it's so light, the air, could we put scrubbers up there, solar-operated scrubbers that would continually circle in those areas and suck in volumes and volumes because the air is so light, and ionize or get rid of that carbon?
Well,
it would stay up there forever.
If you want to scrub the atmosphere, why don't you scrub it at the source where the concentration of the gases is much higher,
right?
And it's easier both thermodynamically and cost-wise to do. Trying to scrub it out of the atmosphere, you're talking about a very dilute system, and there's a huge energy penalty to pay. It's a pretty good energy penalty to pay even if you're trying to scrub the exhaust gases from a coal-fired power plant.
Which they try to do to some extent.
Well, they're trying to develop techniques to do that.
So-called clean coal, eh?
Well, that's one aspect of clean coal.
Okay. Hey, Bill, thanks a lot. Interesting. Very, very nice. Let's go to Lisa in Albany. Lisa.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about the Big Bang and detecting it and light from it. The way I often see this modeled or described in the media, it's as though the Big Bang happened at some point deep in space, and we are with higher and higher technology, better technology, we're able to get closer to that light deeper in space that's older light or whatever to detect when the Big Bang occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem I'm having understanding that is that the Earth is made of matter, and I've always understood light travels faster than matter. So if we're already out at a distance, we Earth's matter are at a distance from the Big Bang, wouldn't the light of us have preceded, the light from the Big Bang have preceded us? So, you know, I'm understanding it's not at a point that the Big Bang occurred, but I can't figure out what the model is for what it actually looks like.
My brain hurts right now. I hope you guys can handle this.
Well, I'll give it a start.
Yeah.
Is, first of all, we're in the Big Bang.
Yes.
In other words, prior to Big Bang, there was nothing. So we're inside of this bubble, effectively, that's supposedly expanding.
Yes.
Okay? And as things move away from us, the further away they are from us, the faster they move away.
Yes.
Okay? The faster they move away, the more the light is redshifted by what's called Doppler shift.
Right.
Okay, and Doppler shift is, you know, if you're at a NASCAR race and you hear the car go, and they go, that's Doppler shift. So it's just moving away, the frequencies are going down. So you start off with light, and as it moves away from you, the frequency drops to microwaves, to infrared, and then to microwaves, and finally to radio waves. So if we look out, we see the microwaves that apparently were produced during the Big Bang, and we can measure those. We can measure those with a microwave antenna. We can find them. And by knowing what frequency that is, knowing that everything started at the same place, we can figure out how far away the event horizon, that's the Big Bang, actually is from us. So that's how we figure out how far away it is.
So like recently there was a revision of the age of the universe.
Right, we get finer and finer. Yeah.
So you could look anywhere in space, and it's a matter of better detection,
finer detection, exactly.
Of what the microwave, or like in this case it's microwave, and if we could detect some other waves or some other aspect, that would tell us something about distance or whatever. But we could look anywhere in space.
That's correct.
To find this. It's not like we're looking deeper into space. We're just looking more accurately into space.
That's right. We're getting a more accurate measure of the temperature of the microwaves, and that tells us temperature of space, effectively, and that tells us how far away it is. So the difference is, you know, 400, 500 million years. We're sort of harboring onto something here.
That's good. Lisa, great question. Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. Ed Stender and George Shaw with us. Let's go to Jim in Albany. Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Quick comment and then a question.
Okay.
Global warming is real. We've had warm spells before and cold spells before. And the last time we had a really warm spell, well, not the last time, but a couple of centuries back, we had a warm spell.
Right.
The crop season was long. Human population exploded. So did the rat population. We ended up with a plague.
Well, all right.
Anyhow, the question was, if we're thinking about the possibility of terraforming Mars, what's the realistic possibility of terraforming someplace like the Los Angeles Basin?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I'm thinking, is it possible to put up enough trees, enough ground cover, that the heat isn't retained in the ground and the temperature starts to drop and maybe more rainfall?
Well, we certainly can affect local climatic conditions. That's actually nothing new. Things like tree belts and wind barriers and these sorts of things have been done for a very long time. So on a local level, this is certainly something that's feasible.
Okay. All right. Very good. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Now, we have about 4 minutes left. Is that enough time for you to cover your homework that you have done after the last one, Ed?
I can cover my homework in 30 seconds.
All right, let's take another call. We'll take one more call here, and then you'll do the homework from the last show. Bill in Albany. Bill, you're on. You got about a minute and a half here.
I can do that. It's very interesting, and I was trying to think of something to help about the Earth warming and the sun rays and whatever, and I go back to the September 11, when they shut the planes down for 2 days,
mm-hmm.
The evaporation tubs that are all over the Earth increased evaporation. And they tried to explain it, and they came up with, well, it must be the exhaust from the jet planes not up in the sky, so we weren't having that additional reflection that we usually have. And I'm just wondering, for a comment or whatever, how about solar planes or anti-gravity planes or cleaner jet engines all the time? It appears that's going to contribute to global warming.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay. I did not know about this. Now, what are evaporation tubs?
They're all over the planet. They, each day, once every 24 hours, somebody goes out, reads how much water is missing, fill the tub to overflow, and they send that dimension in, how much water was evaporated in the previous 24 hours.
All right, Bill, we're out of time. I'll let the scientists answer here. Go ahead.
Go for it, Ed.
Go for it, George.
No, right.
any clouds, condensate trails will have an effect. When the when we had a blackout on the East Coast a couple of years ago, they did a check on the carbon dioxide contents in the area of New York, and it went down. Hmm. So everything has an effect. Certainly.
Okay, now quickly, we have about 30 seconds, so you can tell us what you learned doing homework after the last show.
The last show, somebody asked me about fracking and how you go horizontal with a fracking drill.
Okay.
And effectively what you do is you go down through the, you go down as far as you want to go vertically with what's called a mill. Then you cut a hole sideways into the well. You put a second type of drill, which will drill horizontally in there, and you put a series of pipes down that are able to bend, flex pipes. So the drill on the bottom of the thing is able to rotate, and that rotates the rest of the pipe into the horizontal section.
So that explains it. And now we have a clear picture for the next program when we will answer questions solely
about fracking.
About fracking.
Exactly.
But, you know, you never know what you're going to get on the Science Forum. Today we talked about terraforming, and we answered a lot of questions there. And, boy, it was nice having you here, George Shaw, and I hope you come back again soon. Ed Stander, we know we'll see you again soon.
You can't get rid of me.
Exactly. Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years, QFCC.com. Curtis Lumber, providing kitchens, baths, doors, and windows, paint, flooring, and more since 1890, with 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont, curtislumber.com. Glens Falls Hospital, big city medicine, hometown care, serving six counties in the southern Adirondacks and 28 locations, Twitter, Facebook, and glensfallshospital.org. And Wiawaka, Lake George, New York, an enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903, wiawaka.org, for events. That's it. Sorry if you didn't make it through. We apologize. Get in there early next time, and we'll try to get you on the Science Forum. Thanks to Ed Stander and George Shaw. Thanks to our engineer, Zachary Malloy. Our phones were answered by Colleen O'Connell. And our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Stay tuned now for a news update.